morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. As per usual, this is this week's episode of Powering Bitcoin. I am joined today by Daniel Batten. Hello, Daniel.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, considering we've just been through some biblical weather in Auckland over the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, we can get into that right now. Today, we both will speak about the work that you are doing around Bitcoin's energy use, electricity use, and especially the studies that you are currently taking out to maybe deliver a more clear picture for all of us and deliver alternatives also to the sources that are currently out there. But before we get started, Daniel, can you give me the current block height that we are recording this at?
Whereabouts am I looking? I know the hash rate's 300.
Yeah, it's pretty high.
Block height, 776614. There we go.
Beautiful. The last difficulty change, minus 0.49%, which every miner is happy about. The more than 300 exahash per second, 300.35. I don't think I've mentioned that on this show
before.
That's
a new all-time high, across the 300.
Yeah. Mark. Yep, and as a result, the hash price dipped a bit, I think, since last time to 73.28 US dollars per petahash per day. So, yeah, that's the sort of situation right now as we are recording this. But Daniel, before we get started, maybe give me a bit more feedback on the biblical weather that you mentioned. What's happening?
Well, 3 weeks ago, we had the first 1-in-100-year weather event, and that was... we had the single biggest day of rain in the recorded history of Auckland. We were basically dumped an entire summer's worth of rain in a 24-hour period. And then we were just drying out from that. And then some meteorologists said, we're keeping a close eye on this low pressure zone in the Coral Sea. It looks like it might develop into a tropical cyclone. And if it does, it's going to track towards New Zealand. And everything that they predicted played out exactly as they thought. And as a result, we had a Category 2 cyclone, not a tropical cyclone because we're not in the tropics, but a cyclone nonetheless, Category 2, which hit our country. And that was 2 days ago. And that unloaded another incredible amount of rain plus wind. And the country's still getting to grips with what has actually happened, but it's definitely the most extreme weather event ever in recorded history. And so we've had two of them in 3 weeks.
Wow. What's the result of that? What does it look like right now?
Well, the last one is a lot of the main highways in this country have been disabled by slips or by tears or sometimes eroding, just subsiding completely. So there's just these big gaps. Power outages to about 6% of the entire country was without power. And just massive amounts of damage to property, houses built on slopes that just slipped away and have been destroyed. So it's going to be massive in terms of both loss of livelihood, loss of life, still quantifying, 4 people known dead. Another over 1,000 people who haven't been contactable, which is huge for a country the size of New Zealand. And so we're just kind of waiting and seeing. It's very early stages. And because there's been loss of power, loss of internet, we don't know yet. So probably won't be another few days until we actually know the full scope of damage.
And is this connected to your work somehow? I know you are very
absolutely
heavy
it
to-
is. I was a climate activist before I was a Bitcoiner, and I'm a Bitcoiner, but of course I'm a climate activist, so it's absolutely linked. I did an article around why it had occurred in the first place, and why it occurs is very simple. The first weather event is we've got sea temperatures in Auckland and around the Coral Sea right now, which are between 2-4% higher than there ever were historically. So this is a gargantuan anomaly. And it's been like that for a period of time. And that means a couple of things. Firstly, what it means is that the weather systems, when they gather rain, they have the capacity to hold twice as much rain. So think of it like payload. It can carry twice the payload if it could. So that's what we had 3 weeks ago. The second thing it means is it doesn't mean more cyclones. In fact, it means fewer. But what it means is the cyclones that do form are forming in areas where they didn't form before, such as the Coral Sea, number one. And number two, what feeds tropical cyclones is initially warm water. So what it means is they don't lose their strength as they travel southeast towards New Zealand, which is why we got hit by a full Category 2 cyclone, which we never have before.
Wow.
So absolutely linked to climate change, absolutely linked to why I'm doing what I'm doing, absolutely linked to what I'm spending most of my time doing these days, which is not so much direct action, but seeing if I can make an impact on climate change through investing in climate tech, which I've been doing for the last 5 years, specifically interested in reducing our methane emissions because they are now at a point where there is dangerously high as they ever have been. In fact, the United Nations says it's our single biggest lever to reduce climate change in the next 25 years. And yet it only receives a small fraction of total climate tech investment. So we're looking to shine the attention on that area and to do it before the rest of the world catches up. I think a lot of climate tech gets based on what's fashionable or what people know about. So there's a lot of climate tech money that goes into EVs, into transport, into mobility, but not so much that goes into these unsexy areas like methane mitigation from landfills. And yeah. Similarly, there's a lot of emphasis that goes into climate tech, which is using new sexy cutting-edge technology, which is high risk, which may or may not see the light of day. But there's not actually so much that goes into proven technologies that exist at the moment that can be deployed pre-2030. So that's why I'm incredibly interested in how we mitigate methane, and I'm incredibly interested in how we mitigate it now using existing technologies pre-2030. And that's part of what led me to looking very closely at Bitcoin mining as a way that you can mitigate some of the methane from the world's landfills.
What I always criticize about the discussion around climate change is, you know, we talk about EVs, solar panels, wind power, all of that is fine. What I'm always missing is that the discussion is completely focused on CO2 emissions,
yeah,
right? But not on the other effects. I don't know if you've been following the whole cobalt mining, artisanal mining thing that's been going on.
I follow the mining industry quite a lot because I'm interested in what's happening in Africa. I'm interested in not just environmental activism, but also looking at some of the human costs of economic advancement, let's say. And so if you look at battery technology, for example, which requires cobalt, it requires nickel, it requires lithium in large quantities. And if you look at how that's mined, it's not sustainable. It's not particularly humanitarian. And
not at all.
far from it. And the environmental impact hasn't been quantified, but I think if it ever was, we'd be absolutely shocked and appalled. But anecdotally, it doesn't look good. It does not look good.
Not at all, especially when nobody's responsible, right? And yeah, Everybody's supply chains are super clean, yet we rely, like the current solution to renewable energies fluctuations are batteries, right? If we build as much batteries as we need it, you know, people are going to suffer that we will never know about, or most people. And I think that's really a big problem. And nobody really speaks about it. Everybody's just like, oh no, CO2 mitigation. But what about all the other detrimental effects? And that's why we definitely need new solutions.
Yeah, totally. And you see it because, and this comes back to Bitcoin again, one thing that being in a Bitcoin ecosystem teaches you is just how myopic our view is towards the West. Because if you look at most of the value proposition for Bitcoin right now, most of the value proposition is actually not in the West. It's in countries like, well, it's in areas like the countries of Africa or Latin America. Yeah, exactly, where you are. where you have challenges that you don't have in Western nations, such as hyperinflation, such as are you allowed to buy an orange t-shirt in Zimbabwe without fear of being traced and that being used against you because orange symbolizes the opposition party. Issues such as can you actually protest against death squads in Nigeria and be funded without your bank accounts being frozen? And so these are very real issues. Can you change money from one African nation to another without it going to a middleman in Europe who clips a ticket along the way? So if you want to send money from Nigeria to Kenya right now, you lose quite a lot of that money and it gets clipped by someone not in Africa. Yep. And so Bitcoin is a solution to all of those issues and more, but we don't hear about it. And so many people have come to the conclusion that, oh, Bitcoin's a Ponzi scheme. It's a speculative asset. It has no real value. But the only way you can possibly reach that conclusion is because of a complete media blackout of anything that happens outside areas which we deem worth covering. In other words,
but the that's West. Essentially, if you break it down, that's what's supposed to happen. That's what journalism is supposed to be, right?
Yep.
Delivering new angles, new perspectives, new ways to think about things, investigating new solutions, that kind of thing. That's what's supposed to happen. I recently had a debate with somebody on a German speaking podcast around Bitcoin's energy use. The person worked for Greenpeace and we got to talking and I can only speak for myself, but I would be curious to hear your take on the following, saying that adopting Bitcoin for me and my family and my personal life has led me to reduce my consumption extremely. And I see that in other people.
Exact same. Exact same.
Yeah.
And this is the experience of many Bitcoiners. It's anecdotal, of course, but I'd love to see a study done on that because I'm absolutely convinced that when you have an asset which is encouraging the saving as opposed to spending because it's a deflationary asset, that of course that's going to change human behavior in the opposite direction of non-consumerism. And if you look at how much of the planet's destruction has been based on consumerism, that's got to be a good thing. It's got to be a great thing.
I would love a study. Can you do a study on that next, Daniel, please?
Well, that's not a small piece of work. Dude, do you have any idea what a big piece of work that is?
No. I understand it.
I'm not going to do it first. I'll tell you what. But it's a great idea. And look, I'm glad you're talking about it because, look, out of these jokes, some person may say, hey, Daniel's not going to do it. I don't think you're going to do
it. I've got time.
You go. Yep. But someone's got time, right? Someone's in a university. Someone wants to do a PhD or a master's on something more interesting than whatever their supervisor suggested. It's a brilliant angle, and it's a piece of work that's got to happen. It's got to happen. And it's measurable. It's absolutely measurable.
How would it be measurable, you think?
It's absolutely. You just need a sample size that's big enough, and you need to agree what the measures are. And you need to look at, it would need to be a longitudinal study. You need to do it over like 2 years. That's why it might suit a PhD because they tend to take 3 years. And so you probably spend half that time gathering data. And then you just look at consumption patterns of people who are Bitcoiners versus non-Bitcoiners. So you could do it one of two ways. You could have two groups and compare them and have a sufficiently large sample size that they're seen to be random. Or you could have a larger longitudinal study that looks like at the pre-Bitcoin and the post-Bitcoin spending behaviors. And you just have like a transparent ledger of the person spending and you just have some measures of how it's changed and the relative weighting of saving versus spending. It would be quite easy. It would take a long time.
Do you know if there is any existing method out there to sort of quantify? I don't know what the right term is here, but take for instance,
what you're looking to do is to quantify consumption, and it's raw.
No, consumers. What I'm trying to quantify is waste. Yeah. Look at, for instance, all the clothes that are being burned, you know, or are being shipped to South America to be delivered into a desert, and then we call it growth for the economy because they're being produced, right? What is there any way to quantify that waste? Like the value that's being disregarded.
You could quantify a whole lot of things. You could quantify what the what their true cost is, like their true impact. A lot of smart people have tried to do things like they've quantified in dollar terms what the impact of certain types of environmental damage is. So we know, for example, that the cotton industry is a gargantuan user of water, and that in places in the former Soviet Union, massive bodies of water have dried up completely to serve the cotton industry because it's so water hungry. And you can, people have quantified what the economic cost of that is. So yeah, if you're taking fast fashion, for example, you can look at, okay, how much water has been wasted? What's the economic cost? There are existing measures. Then you look at the standard ones, such as what's the carbon footprint of that industry? And then you look at, okay, what's the actual utility of those clothes? How long, how many times are they worn? You know, how long does that last before it becomes unfashionable? You can quantify the stuff if you want to do it. I guess the question is whether it, whether the effort to reward ratio is big enough. Like you really only want to do a study like that if you think it's going to change behaviors or it's going to get picked up and circulated, or if you, you it doesn't just become a like my thesis that I wrote many years ago, which became a good doorstop, or sometimes I use it to prop up my microphone if it's the wrong height, but it's probably been read by three people. So if you're going to do that work, you want to make sure that you've got some people who are going to read it at the end of it, and preferably they're going to start thinking differently.
And make more out of it. Definitely. And somebody needs to pay for it as well, because you can't sit for 3 years
You know, work. It's probably not going to be someone from the fashion industry.
I would love something like that. So if you're out there, you have time.
Yeah, go do it. It's a great study. It can change the world. Let's do it,
man. I mean, the amount of times I need a study like that to show, like, look at the destruction the fiat system is causing, and look at all the cost, and then please don't talk to me about this minuscule amount of energy that Bitcoin is using in comparison. That would be great. Daniel, but maybe let's get back to the main topic at hand. Just to sum up, maybe, how did you get into Bitcoin specifically? Like, how did you discover Bitcoin mining?
Completely Bitcoin? By accident. So I had a number of friends in the environmental movement who were telling me that Bitcoin was bad for the environment. I had a single friend in the Bitcoin community who was telling me that it was good for the environment. And I thought, okay, so normally human behavior says you believe what your tribe believes, right? We like to think that we're these rational creatures, but actually we're creatures of habit. We're much more guided by what our peers think. So I didn't have the luxury of that being possible because I had two communities and they were saying different things. So what do? You either say, oh, come on, guys, let's see everyone get along. Or you can try and, you know, go feel like an imposter each time you go into one community. You can pretend you believe one thing one time, one another thing and the other. Or you can just kind of ignore and skirt around the issue. But I chose to do none of those things. I was actually sufficiently curious about it. I thought, I'm going to find out for myself. And I had some time. And I thought, you know what? I like doing research. I haven't done it for a little while. Let's dust off my analysis hat and actually do some analysis again and work it out. Because when I looked around the Bitcoin community, I heard a lot of people saying it's good for the environment, but I didn't hear a lot of people who'd quantified, you know, how is it good for the environment? Okay, I heard people say, you know, it helps the build out of the renewable grid. And I was like, well, how do you know that? And they'd give me convincing sounding logic. I said, okay, to what extent? You know, how much faster can it go? Well, it's got the thing called demand response. Okay, how much decarbonizing does demand response give? And that's when I hit upon blanks. So I thought, well, that doesn't mean that it's just because these answers haven't been generated. That could just be because Bitcoin's new, and it turned out that was the case. So, well, I can probably do the maths on that. They're not hard mathematical questions to answer. So let's go and answer them. And so I started. And so I started off by answering the question, what's the net climate impact of Bitcoin? I wanted to understand whether it was net positive or net negative. And I was kind of expecting the answer would be somewhere, yeah, it's kind of bad in this respect, but it's good in this respect. And the answer ends up somewhere kind of neutral or somewhere slightly negative or slightly positive. Nowhere in my wildest dreams was I imagining the answer would be that properly utilized, it can mitigate 0.15 degrees of Celsius of climate change. So I was blown away by that. I just was not expecting it. And there was all this moment where I was like, oh, crap, that sounds so big that no one's going to believe it. And I said, well, I don't care. I've got a duty to say it as it is. As I said in a tweet recently, understatement is just as dishonest as overstatement. So I'm just going to say it as it is. This is what the data is telling me. The data tells me that Bitcoin mining, properly deployed using vented methane-based energy sources, has the potential to mitigate 0.15 degrees Celsius of climate change. Simple as that. And if you look at what the and that's net, by the way. That's even calculating the fact that it causes a few emissions along the way. But the net difference is it's going to stop 0.15 degrees if correctly deployed using vented methane. So that got me thinking, okay, that's a very different message to what we hear. And then I thought, well, why is the message that we're hearing so different to what the data is telling me? And then it hit me. The answer was obvious. And because I'd seen it before, and I'd seen it when I was running my first technology company, where we had a disruptive technology. It's irrelevant what it was, but it happened to be a niche tool for molecular biologists that helped them to visualize genomic information, which is very niche, but it was very useful at the time. If you happen to be an academic researcher who was wanting to use Craig Venter's genome sequence and actually do something with it, without using your own academic freeware tools, which are cumbersome and difficult. But when we started to create the technology, and it wasn't me who created it, we had some very smart developers who did that. It's my job to make sure the company had enough money to continue to do the development. But we actually disrupted the incumbent because we had a far better technology, superior in every way possible, much better for the scientists. And then what the incumbent did was they basically spread all this nonsense about us. They sort of say, oh, you can't use Genius because it doesn't, you can't extract your files or they will disappear, or you can't use it in a client server environment, or it has these security. And we're like, where is this nonsense coming from? And I was completely naive to it. And then I realized what it was. It's called FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And it's standard operating procedure. Whenever you have to understand the relationship between disruptors and disrupted. So what the disruptor does is they have a cool technology. They think just because they have a cool technology that everyone will embrace it. And then what the disrupted party does is they realize, holy crap, there's these people who've got a superior technology to us. How do we maintain our base? And the answer is always fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Doesn't have to be true. Just have to repeat it enough times that people believe it. So that's exactly what's happened with Bitcoin. And you only have to look to the people who are disrupted, and that's obviously the central banks, because Bitcoin disintermediates central banks. And it doesn't take a detective to work out that the FUD comes from the central bankers. And because...
Hello, Alex DeFries.
Yeah, exactly. They don't even try and hide it. And so as soon as that piece of the puzzle came into effect, I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Okay, so what we're seeing is basically it is a sea of misinformation. But they've been very successful because they've captured the mainstream media. Obviously, they've got vast resources at their disposal. They have vast PR channels, which they can pump. They can have a media blackout and anything positive about Bitcoin in the environment. Case in point, there are now 40 sustainable Bitcoin mining organizations bigger than 1 megawatt. There is one Bitcoin mining operation bigger than 1 megawatt that uses fossil fuel exclusively. So 40-1 ratio. But you hear zero coverage about the 40 who use renewables. And you hear basically four times. So you take that one and you multiply it by four, and you kind of, in the media, coverage about people who use fossil fuels. So not only do you hear about that one that uses fossil fuel, but you hear other people who don't use fossil fuel or don't use it anymore, as if they are using coal, for example. So it's been absolutely fascinating to see that play out. So as soon as I understood that, I'm like, okay, I get it now. I see the landscape. I see the sea of disinformation and misinformation that's been spread. I see why good people in the environmental movement have come to believe what they believe. But I can also see what the data is saying, and it's a complete opposite.
So if we know how it works, Daniel, how do we game it? And let me add something to this. It's becoming somewhat of a regular thing because on the episode about Mint Green, when I had Colin on, we talked about this for the first time, and I asked Nate, who was on last week, the same thing. The question is, why do you think Bitcoin has to defend its energy use so much? Why is the general narrative so toxic? Now, you alluded to this already, and the other guys agreed that basically it's very easy to quantify what the amount of electricity is that Bitcoin consumes. And it's very difficult to quantify the electricity or energy use of the fiat system. So it makes it very attackable. Do you think that plays a big part? And how do we game the system if we believe to understand?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because on one hand, people criticize Bitcoin miners for not being transparent enough. But then, in fact, Bitcoin is the most transparent industry about its energy usage of any industry in the world. And that's why it can be attacked in the first place. And then the people who are asking for more transparency are the ones who are attacking it, the Elizabeth Warrens of this world, who basically attack based on zero fact. And they're saying, can you please supply us with more information that we can use against you to attack you with more, with a finer, sharpened saw? Well, of course, people aren't going to want to be transparent with her. But they've been completely transparent with me. Bitcoin miners are incredibly transparent about people who they can trust or people they sense have neutral motives, but not people who are going to clearly use it against them. I'm sure that if you're in certain parts of Nigeria and there was a census that came around about which political affiliations you had, and said, oh, just be transparent. But if you're being asked by SARS, the death squad, you probably feel a little bit reticent about being transparent with them. So, yeah. So, look, in terms of how you game it, well, there's a couple of principles here. The first one is that you don't accept the framing. And I made the tweet today. There's a lot of, if you do a Google search on sustainable Bitcoin mining, 3 out of the 9 responses that I got on Google were asking the question, can Bitcoin become clean? Can Bitcoin go green? And I said, that's like saying, can broccoli become healthy? It's a question that you can only ask if you understand so little about the topic that you can't even formulate a sensible question about it, or because you've been so utterly misinformed that you ask a question that betrays to the extent to which you've been misinformed. So,
yeah, but let me guess. And then they're talking about proof of stake.
Yeah, right? How did you guess? So the framing is wrong. And so you've got to actually change the frame because otherwise you're just on the back foot. And so what I say is, that question actually makes no sense because you're asking me, and I would say you might as well ask me, how does broccoli become healthy? And they say, broccoli already is healthy. And I say, yeah, Bitcoin's already green. Well, no, it's not. I said, well, how do you know? Well, because I read some mainstream media articles all cited a central banker who said that it's not. So,
yeah, the same question is, can EVs become green?
Yeah, exactly. So changing the frame is important. And so I don't get into this. I see a lot of Bitcoiners make the mistake of trying to defend its energy usage, which is a terrible thing to do. Never do that. The fact that the major problem with Bitcoin at the moment is it uses nowhere near enough energy, because in order to soak up all, and it sounds completely counterintuitive, right? But bear with me here, not to you, I know. But to
hold on, yeah. just to interrupt you. Sorry. The key line at the end of every episode is Bitcoin does not consume enough electricity.
Yeah, it's true. It's
and a key question
true.
Of mine that I like to ask is always, what do you think? But you're answering it right now. So
it needs to consume a whole lot more for a whole bunch of reasons. In order to proliferate the renewable build out of the grid, in order to incentivize more solar and more wind power, in order to do better response to counteract the intermittency of the renewables. We know that already, and we can quantify that, and that's been well quantified. The bit that I'm specifically interested in is that Bitcoin is very unique because it's the only industry which can scale profitably to eat up our most dangerous source of environmental pollution right now in terms of climate change, and that's methane. And Bitcoin mining eats methane, and it eats it because it turns that methane into... Well, Bitcoin doesn't, generators do, but you have a generator on site in a landfill, say, and I know you're going to talk to Adam about this and he'll go into better detail than I will. But the way that I look at it is you have a generator on a landfill and it turns that methane into electricity, and then you use that electricity for something on site because it's way too prohibitively expensive to build out the pylons to transport it to the grid or to build out a gas pipeline. So it has to be used on site. And of all the on-site uses, basically it comes down to data centers are it. And it turns out the most cost-effective type of data center is a Bitcoin mining data center by far. And so this is really the only scalable technology that can eat up our gargantuan leakages of methane emissions into the atmosphere from landfills, which are causing climate havoc right now. So the more energy it uses, the more methane we can mitigate. That simple.
Why are you saying it's more profitable than other data type data center operations? My key thing is always, look, it's always interruptible. Yeah. You cannot say that about other data center operations.
There's about three or four reasons. That is the main reason it's interruptible. If you want to have like, you can't use an Amazon data center, you know, powered on Bitcoin on landfill gas. Because it's got to have 99.99999% availability or more. If that goes down, then you know, Netflix goes down or Disney goes down. So you know, people don't like that. So whereas if a Bitcoin mining operation goes down, so what? It's like you lose a few seconds. It's not like a discrete operation. It's performing the same operation trillions of times per second. So you lose nothing other than this tiny fraction of time where it's not mining Bitcoin, which matters very little in the greater scheme of things. So it's very unique in that way. It's very forgiving. That means you don't have to have redundancy. So you don't have to have a secondary system, a secondary generator. So immediately that cuts your generation costs in half. Second thing is the actual equipment itself. It's performing a single operation. It's an ASIC. That's going to be much more cost-effective than other types of compute resource, particularly at today's prices. Third thing is the amount of cooling and the amount of climate resilience that it requires. You can put these things in shipping containers and give them air cooling or some basic water cooling. You don't have to, if you look at modern data centers, they look like bunkers that are built during wartime because they have to be incredibly resilient to the increasing prevalence of extreme climate events. So again, that brings the cost down again. So the amount of cost reduction is actually substantial. And you can build them very fast and it can be up and mining Bitcoin very quickly. The beauty is once you've done that and once you've started to monetize that wasted resource of methane, then it can actually make sense. And you can say, okay, now that we've done that, now actually we can bring a data center in there. And this is what Crusoe Energy have started doing because now you've actually already got the Bitcoin miners in there. You've already got the generator. So you have your backup generator. Rather than just having a backup generator just in case it goes down and it's only used 1 hour a year, you can have your backup generator being used to mine Bitcoin 24/7, 365 days a year. So now it makes total economic sense. So it has this incredible synergy where it works with other industries very well so that they don't have these just-in-case assets. Another example is a gas peaker plant on the grid, which sits there idle and idling for most of the year, incredibly expensive resource, fossil fuel power. What many people don't know is it has to idle, so it's releasing carbon into the atmosphere 24/7 just for these few hours a week or few hours a month where peak load gets so big that the generator, the grid operator has to ring up the gas peaker plant and say, hey, please fire it up because we're about to reach capacity. Now, you don't have to do that. You can have Bitcoin mining and you can control that and you can see the demand going up and you can actually phone your Bitcoin mining operation and say, can you power down? So you can control it at the source of your demand rather than at the source of supply. So again, Bitcoin is taking this asset and saying, we don't actually need that asset anymore. You can retire that gas peaker plant. So it's just phenomenal what it does because of, as you say, the location agnostic and time agnostic features of it.
Yeah, what came to me now, this incredibly flexible demand is also, like what came to me now is that obviously you can't put data centers everywhere. So Bitcoin mining is just more flexible and more has more use cases because you don't have big data pipelines everywhere. All you need is a 2G connection for a Bitcoin miner, right? It's very small amounts of data that need to be transmitted, the shares to a pool mostly, right? So there's another reason why Bitcoin mining over other data centers, because it just has more applications that can make use of it, or more sites, more locations. Daniel, let's get into the latest piece you've done. We've talked about, energy usage and the electricity usage that Bitcoin has and the sources that are out there. You know, we all know the Cambridge source, the Alex de Vries source, and the BMC source. Mainly, those are the three that are most commonly used. Quickly, before we get into that, though, your response to people that say, hey, we cannot trust the numbers from the Bitcoin Mining Council because they come directly from the industry, and we wouldn't also take numbers or quantified data by the tobacco industry on cigarette use. What's your quick response to that?
Quick response is it's really hard to respond to because they've got a point. So when it comes from an industry body, there's two things that are true. Number one is that industry body is theoretically they're the best qualified because by virtue of being an industry body, they know all the different industries. So they're both the best suited, but the least well-suited because there's the biggest potential conflict of interest. Then you've got to look and say, well, why? Let's look at Bitcoin Mining Council specifically and say, yes, okay, there's a theoretical conflict of interest, but that doesn't mean that they're going to do the wrong thing and skew the data necessarily. So you can't say that. You've got to be a little bit more sophisticated. And you say, well, what vested interest would they have unintentionally skewing the data? Actually, very little. All they would succeed in doing is losing credibility. Bitcoin is by DNA tend to be pretty transparent. The methodology that they've used is, again, very transparent. They've been very transparent about the fact that they are using self-generated surveys. They've been transparent about the fact that that doesn't cover the entire network. They've been transparent about the fact that the portion of hash rate which they cover, which was a bit over 50, about 60-something percent of that is renewable energy, I think 66 at latest calculation. But then they have also done a calculation on the remaining percent, and they haven't assumed that it's the same proportion, it's a lesser proportion, and they've come up with an overall average. So it's a pretty robust methodology. The one criticism which a purist data gatherer would make was that because it's self-filled in surveys, there may be some inaccuracies in those surveys, which is possible, because you could have people who are disclosing, for example, their theoretical hash rate based on the number of ASICs they have, what they should be doing, rather than the actual hash rate they achieved, which when you have to subtract things like some of the machines were down, or they use some of that time to sell demand response back to the grid, so they actually weren't mining, so they didn't utilize that entire hash rate. So those things are possible. And so you've got to acknowledge that. Overall, when I looked at the numbers, I thought, well, this is before I did my own study. I thought that the Bitcoin mining numbers, they correspond more with what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing. And then I looked at the Cambridge numbers and I just thought, I don't see how that can possibly be right, because I've spoken to about 40 different Bitcoin mining collectives or organizations who are doing sustainable mining, and they represent about 15% of hash rate. And so for the number 37% to be accurate, what it means is the entire rest of the world only contributes another 22%. And that's vastly less than just plugging it in directly to the grid. That just makes no sense. That must be inaccurate. And so then I thought, something's not right. I wonder if they're even including off-grid mining. And so I asked the question, I checked the website, and I think it was either Baseload or Level 39 who alerted me to the fact that they disclosed transparently on their website that they don't include off-grid mining and they don't include flare gas. And I'm like, that would explain it. That would explain the difference. And I thought, well, at the moment we have these two reports, and if you're neutral in the middle, like you don't care about Bitcoin, but you don't care about fiat either, you just kind of want the truth, you're just curious. And you're looking at one report which is from Cambridge, right, with all the brand appeal of Cambridge and hundreds of years of history, and you're looking at one from an industry body, which one would you probably trust? So you see that, you see the problem. So when you, when you're talking to, and this is one of the reasons I looked at it, I said, well, of course people are going to gravitate towards the Cambridge one. Of course, they're going to say that's an independent, reputable academic body using an academic methodology with no vested interest. And the other one, well, they may be more accurate, but we just can't tell. And so I thought, well, whilst we cannot base the data on what appears to be so based on our, on our preferences and prejudices, it has to be based on what is it, who is actually using the most correct methodology. And the way I was looking at it, I was saying, well, actually, the Bitcoin Mining Council is using a better methodology, because whilst their method of data capturing, probably Cambridge is using a more reputable method of data capture, the Bitcoin Mining Council has the more complete data set. And that's what's most important. They have a full data set, whereas I could see that Cambridge did not. So I thought, okay, let's see if we can somehow combine the best of the both worlds and not rely on self-reported data. Let's see if we can actually leverage the Cambridge model and use the Cambridge model. And I can come up with a third model, which uses Cambridge as its base, which uses their own acknowledgement that there are some forms of mining which they don't include. Let's quantify the impact of those exclusions. Let's augment them onto Cambridge's own model, and then let's come up with the true, complete picture of sustainable Bitcoin mining. And that's what I did.
Yeah, beautiful. Absolutely. We're going to get into a few more questions on that report. But first, I know you outlined now why you did it, but I remember reading when I went through it that you had sort of three different questions that you wanted to answer specifically. And why those? Can you give some background to that? So as this sort of setup to the piece that you have done?
Yeah, I wanted to understand what the percentage of Bitcoin mining was. I wanted to understand, firstly, whether it could be quantified. I wanted to understand if Cambridge was right. Secondly, I wanted to understand whether, if there were some exclusions from their model, whether that could be quantified. And then thirdly, I wanted to find out what the net impact of quantifying, capturing, quantifying all the exclusions from the model, if there were exclusions, what they were. And it turned out that, yes, it was an incomplete data set. Yes, the things that were excluded were significant. They weren't trivial exclusions. They were meaningful exclusions which had a material impact on the overall calculation. Yes, they could be quantified very accurately. And yes, when you quantified them, you got a figure which was substantially north of Cambridge's own figure.
Okay, understood. The off-grid miners, which are missing from the Cambridge study, they make up a gargantuan amount and compared to all the other factors. And just to inform everybody, we're not going to go through the whole article now. It's going to be linked in the show notes. Definitely read it if this is interesting to you. The reason why you didn't do a podcast about it is because it's not really podcast friendly. Yeah. So let's just maybe color it out with a few notes here. Can you give me information on the data of all the off-grid miners? Where did you find them? Because typically, yes, while Bitcoin miners tend to be very transparent, they also don't advertise themselves. Where did you find all of them to speak to them?
There were three layers. The first is looking at all the public miners. So that was easy. And that covered probably about 95% of the hash rate. So it was actually pretty easy, because the public miners are the ones who also have, they're the largest miners too, right? And then you just look and say, well, who else is doing it who's not a publicly listed mining company? So in many cases, I would just, I would phone them up and I'd ask them questions, or I'd email them and I'd say, hey, can you give me some more data about? The other thing that had been happening was that we were, because I'm a climate tech investor, I was saying, hey, we're actually interested in seeing whether we can invest in Bitcoin mining in the future. And so we wanted to start looking at the sort of Bitcoin mining companies we might invest in. At this stage, we didn't know whether we wanted to look at grid side or whether we wanted to look at fermented methane. We eventually formed a view. But in the meantime, we ended up speaking to a huge number of Bitcoin mining companies, forming relationships with them, gaining their trust. They could see that we had good intentions. Because I was tweeting about what I was finding out regularly, they were like, oh, finally, we've got a PR department. Right? Because Bitcoin miners and engineers, it's not their job to be telling the world how green they are. So when I started saying, hey, these guys are actually really green, not from spin, but just actually telling the story, which was untold, that they didn't have either the time or the inclination to tell. I was just, hey, but this is a story that needs to be told. They're pretty happy because it was a counter narrative that was welcome, let's say. And my efforts to quantify it were also pretty welcome by it. So they were pretty trusting when I reached out. Some of them reached out to me. I didn't even have to. Some of the public mining corporations, and even in one case, one of the CEOs of one of the publicly traded mining corporations reached out and wanted to talk about what we were doing. So it wasn't hard to start to find out who they were. And then we even found out, to your point, we found out about two different off-grid flared gas miners that no one knows about. And they said, hey, we love what you're doing. We just want you to know that we're around, and please don't tell anyone who we are, but here's how much we're mining, and here's how many megawatts of power we're using, and here's our hash rate. And, you know, we went for a process of verifying that, and I agreed that I would keep their names secret because they didn't want the undue attention. And these, just to be clear, these are people who are carbon negative miners. So they are using methane that otherwise would have gone into the atmosphere. So they're actually performing a climate net benefit.
And so now I remember the number plus 10.1%. Can you give a bit of feedback on how that exactly was calculated to be incorporated based on the
Yes. So I built a model which has numerous different data inputs, and it looks at so it breaks it down into different categories. So you have off-grid flared, you have off-grid mixed mining, off-grid fossil fuel mining, which is minuscule, off-grid renewable. And then you have on-grid, and then the on-grid is divided into different jurisdictions based on the relative fossil fuel intensity of those different jurisdictions. And so basically it's lines in a spreadsheet. I use spreadsheet Excel because they're not complex mathematical models, and that's the best tool available for the task. And you basically then can manipulate the information and see, you can run different simulations. So for example, you can say, oh, if this increased so much, what would it do to the overall calculation? And so when you combine the off-grid hydro that is occurring in China, and then you combine with the, I think I've got around 30, this is excluding the flared gas miners, but the ones who are using solar, wind, and hydro, and you can, so going through each one of them step by step, adding up the total hash rate of each one, getting a total, calculating how much of that hash rate was renewable, then factoring in things such as, even if they're using 100% renewable energy, even if they're connected to the grid, even if they never use it, you still can't call them 100% renewable. So you have to discount it to 99%. And then if companies such as one of the big publicly listed ones, for example, even if you're using 100% renewable, we have to ask questions like, well, what happens when there's no wind? And they say, oh, we use the ERCOT grid. We use the Texas grid. I say, okay, well, how much of the time? And then you have to – so there's a lot – they're not complex mathematical calculations, but there's a lot of math behind it. You add that number up. You put – it's incredibly granular. It's not sexy work. It's grunt work. It's proof of work in its truest form. It takes a lot of time, and it's not sexy maths. But it works. And you go through it line item by line item, and you add them up, and you punch it into your spreadsheet, and it tells you that when you add that impact in, and then you can take it away, you can simulate, and you say, let's now, because the first thing I had to do was reproduce the Cambridge model. So then I excluded them all from the model and put them back to their jurisdiction, which is what Cambridge assumes. So these ones, okay, let's not calculate based on them using 100% wind energy from the US. Let's assume, as the Cambridge model does, okay, they're in the US, so they must be using the grid, which they're not. So we only calculated at 39% or 40%. So then I simulated that, reproduced the Cambridge model, and then changed it to the off-grid component, and I could see that the difference was 10.1%.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, I'm glad you said that, because I was going to sum it up also by saying you basically reproduce the Cambridge model.
You got to reproduce the Cambridge model. So I did that. Interestingly, my calculation came up a little bit harsher than theirs. So when I reproduced the Cambridge model, I came out that it was only 37.1. They came up with 37.6. But I suspect that's because they did a more granular breakdown of Bitcoin mining in China. They did it province by province, where I did it at the national scale. So there's small differences.
Why do you think that the off-grid mining was not included?
Because when they first built their model, it didn't make a difference because there's hardly any of it.
The problem of the Cambridge model is also the Cambridge. Okay, sorry.
So the Cambridge model. So let's be really clear. Cambridge were the first ones in the world who actually built any sort of proper model at all, which was neutral, which actually based on a sound methodology, and which was based on sound data. So that was, and when they built it first around 2019, it was very accurate because there was no flared gas mining to speak of. They had an up-to-date Bitcoin mining map, and there was no off-grid renewable mining to speak of either. So it didn't matter that they didn't factor it in, because it wouldn't have made a material difference. And then what happened between mid-2020 and today, so over a 2.5-year period, is suddenly what's happened is the mining economics have changed, and it's no longer economical to mine on the grid. Bitcoin miners have got much smarter about seeking wasted sources of energy. They've innovated, which happens in any industry. And they've just been asking questions. They've just got smarter. What about if we use this wasted source of energy? What about this stranded source of energy? And they just kept on innovating. And that's meant that suddenly, over a very short period of time, it's gone from almost zero to like 20%+ just off-grid, and then another almost 20%, more than 20% actually, through ERCOT, this islanded grid. And that makes a huge difference to the overall calculation, where most of those off-grid miners are using renewable. So it's I liken it to a quant trading algorithm, which is a great algorithm, but it's just lost its tune over time as the market conditions have changed. And so what I suspect they'll do, that they know this as well, and they will update their model to reflect those changes, but there's just a bit of a lag in the meantime. But I didn't want to wait until, you know, they updated their model, because in the meantime, you've got a whole lot of environmental organizations, you've got a whole lot of people with vested political interests who are using this model against Bitcoin. So I wanted to make sure that as soon as possible, we had a model which factored in the true picture of the Bitcoin network.
And now, do you know the persons responsible behind the Cambridge study? Is the weakness of theirs that they interface with a very, very rapidly innovating and very rapidly changing industry as well? How often do they update their model, if at all?
Yeah, so the model is, they face the same constraints that any academic institute faces, and that is limited resources and competing attention. So the Cambridge Center for Alternative Finance, they monitor a whole lot of things, of which one is digital assets. And then within digital assets, one of them is Bitcoin. So it's not as if they have their whole focus on Bitcoin. They're also monitoring Ethereum. And so right now, their focus is on some different areas. I think it's going to rapidly return to Bitcoin again. So I think it's just the inherent restraints that any academic institute has, that they can only update it so often. And when you're talking about something such as, now we've got to factor in off-grid mining, that's going to be a little bit harder for an academic institute to do, because that's the sort of work you can only, you've actually got to, as we were talking about beforehand, that's a lot of grunt work. It's not, you're not dealing with sophisticated mathematics, it's grunt work. So it's not the sort that an academic institute will necessarily want to do. And it's time consuming. And it also relies on, this is where the Bitcoin Mining Council and I have advantages, because we have existing connections to Bitcoin mining. So it's relatively easier for us to get that information than it would be for Cambridge starting from scratch.
Yeah. Okay. Would you say that your model is currently the most accurate out there, and what can maybe be done to improve the model further?
I wouldn't say it's the. I would say definitely it's substantially more accurate than the Cambridge one, and that's because it uses the Cambridge one. Then it adds on the exclusions. So there's no question it's substantially more accurate than that. I wouldn't go so far to say that it's more accurate than the Bitcoin Mining Council. their figure comes at around about 6% higher than mine. I'm not going to say their figure's wrong. Their figure might be more correct. We've just used slightly different approaches. My approach has been to find the lower limit. So when I say it's 52.6%, that's because whenever there's been a lack of clarity, I've erred on the side of caution. Whereas it's possible that when you're getting self-reported data, there may be some instances where Bitcoin mining, as I was saying earlier, have declared their theoretical hash rate rather than their actual hash rate. So there may be a slight over-reporting, I'm speculating here, with the Bitcoin Mining Council, and there's probably a slight under-reporting with my model. So my gut feel says the true figure is probably somewhere in the middle between the two, probably be about 55.
Okay, so it might not be the most accurate, right? But it has the lower bound limit, which you mentioned. Quickly update me, the BMC, how much of the hash rate do they sort of report on versus what you are doing?
So what they're doing based on their own members, I think their members represent around 55% of overall hash rate, roughly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The data I'm looking at, so I'm not looking only at people who are members of a council, so I'm looking at all miners all across the world, whether they're Bitcoin Mining Council members or not. And I'm looking at everyone who has more than a megawatt of power. So by my estimation, it's probably 98% of Bitcoin miners who are out there by hash rate.
Right. So that's something you have got going for you over them, I guess.
Well, I don't think it's a competition. I really don't. It's just we're using different approaches. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe I framed that wrong. I didn't mean to make you feel like there was any competition. Obviously not. I'm just saying. This model uses about 98%. You know, yeah. Instead of just the 55. So you can compare the two.
In creating these models, I mean, I've been in touch with both Alex at the Cambridge Center of Alternative Finance and with Michael Saylor as well. So they're both aware of this. They've both been very encouraging and very supportive of the need for more transparency and more information. And they all have a feeling that the more information, the more quality empirical data we have, the better.
All right. So that answers, I guess, one of the audience questions that I have for you. If you are in touch with the Cambridge Institute to make them aware of these findings, and you just answered that with yes.
And to their credit, so are they, very much so. They are very well aware of the model limitations because, again, to their credit, they say so transparently on their website.
Yeah, beautiful. And did you? I have two more audience questions for you. Did you approach any non-Bitcoin linked media outlets to present your findings and make them more publicly known?
Not at the stage. That may come down the track. This is pretty early. You're actually getting a little bit of a sneak preview. I've just written a Bitcoin magazine article on it, which will go live in a couple of days' time, but you're basically the first to get your hands on it. So good timing.
Hey, yeah. There you go. Nice. last one. Are you planning to get this study somehow certified?
Look, I'm open to it. I'm at the moment, you know, everything I don't receive any funding for anything I do. I do it because I'm passionate about the truth, and I'm crazy enough to spend time going through grunt work, and I like doing the analysis. And it was important to me because if I was going to dedicate some of my life to technologies which I believe will make a difference to the world, I want to make sure they can actually make a difference to the world. So really, I was looking for the answer for myself primarily, and it turned out some of the research I was doing was useful to some other people. So I never really intended to I honestly was really only seeking it for me to start with, and it came as a bit of a surprise that other people cared about it as well. So look, if it heads in that direction and someone wants to do that and certify it, I'm all for it. And I'd happily work with them to do that.
Sounds really good. I mean, look, this is unfortunately what's needed. I think there's many comparisons out there where people who really stand behind the technology spend their time and energy doing the proof of work as you did, doing the unsexy math just to prove a point and to get an alternative view out there because they just deeply care about it. So I want to thank you also for the work you're doing because it's incredibly important. And I currently, you know, I was like, why am I not doing it myself? Probably because also not have the background, but I'm happy to do my part and get it out there to the few people that are listening to this. So maybe let's give a bit of an outlook, Daniel. Where do we go from here? What comes next? What are your expectations also for the Bitcoin network in general? Maybe alluding to hash price being in the dumpster right now. How does Bitcoin mining evolve?
The direction that I see it heading is, number one, it's absolutely trending towards stranded energy, towards wasted energy, and towards renewable energy. Second thing is that I see the portion of the network which is powered off waste gas, so flared and vented, rising substantially over the next 5 years, to the point where the entire network actually, definitely inside the next 5 years, possibly a lot sooner than that, it depends on a number of variables, including macroeconomic events, where the entire network becomes net emission reducing. The other thing that I see happening is, in terms of the mining industry itself, is I see it moving, to use an agricultural metaphor, from monoculture to permaculture, where at the minute you have these monocultural Bitcoin mining only massive warehouses, and all they do is Bitcoin mining, and a few of them sell demand response services back to the grid. I see that becoming less common and less resilient. As we've just found out, miners who do that, it's not actually a very good business model. It's not very resilient during bear market cycles. The ones that will do well through bull and bear markets as miners will have multiple streams of income, of which Bitcoin mining is just one, and it might not even be the most lucrative one. And so the other alternatives might, so you have Bitcoin mining, heat recycling, phenomenal potential in heat recycling. Then we have carbon credits, we have renewable energy credits, we have any number of other possible people getting more and more innovative about how you can use a different answer. And of course, all the different ancillary services you can sell back to the grid, which isn't just demand response, it's also frequency control, the voltage stabilization, spinning reserve, inertia, a whole lot of terms which probably don't mean much to people, but they're all deeply meaningful and deeply valuable to grid operators in terms of stabilizing the grid, measuring and monitoring, and allowing you to precisely calibrate the frequency of a grid at a given moment so it's not going to incur blackouts, where Bitcoin mining is really, as Sean Connell says, the Rolls Royce of ancillary services to the grid. So we're going to see that this is going to become more and more common. And the actual Bitcoin mined as a line item on the budget of these companies will be just be one of several revenue line items. And then what's going to happen, and Adam can tell you more about this, is you'll see that Bitcoin becomes the enabler, becomes a catalyst, where, for example, you've got an off-grid solar operator and they couldn't get onto the grid because they didn't have a customer, and then Bitcoin said, hey, we can be an off-grid customer. And they're like, really? You're kidding me? And they realize that Bitcoin mining is just this customer, this absolute dream customer that doesn't need grid connection. They can locate in the middle of a desert or miles away from anywhere. They don't care. And they don't even care if it's intermittent energy. It's like, you're kidding me, right? It's ideal customer. But then once that solar or wind operation becomes profitable, then and a going concern, then it actually can help it get grid connected. Then it can help it to find other users. Similarly with landfills, once they have monetized the value of that initial capital expenditure to get the generator, to get the purifier, to get the terraforming of the land, to get the compliance certification, to get the carbon credits monitoring and measuring and reporting and up and running, then once it's a going concern, then say, hey, what else can we do with this energy? Well, we could use it to power e-vehicles. We could use it to, actually, we could sell it back to the grid now because it makes economic sense because we've already got the generator and it's paid itself off. Or we could do some other stuff with it. And so you're going to see people, Bitcoin mining becoming this enabler where it might only be the user of energy for like a period of 4 years. So you could have a landfill that starts off with Bitcoin mining and then it transitions to a different sort of data center, but it could never have just gone straight to that data center in the first place. It'd be like a child trying to go from rolling along on the floor to walk to dancing without learning how to crawl and walk in between. It's not going to happen. You need those intermediate steps, and we haven't had them. And then you're going to see people like Nate Harmon, who's this amazing guy from Hawaii with just so much enthusiasm for ocean thermal energy current technology. And he's developing this system which has been neglected for a long time, which uses the ocean's thermal currents as a source of renewable baseload energy. But it's never been economically viable because you had to tether these stations out in sea. You had to make them hurricane resistant. You had to run these big underground cables to connect them to the grid. You see the common connection here. The moment you have to do those things to get them grid connected, the costs go through the roof. But again, because Bitcoin mining is agnostic, you have a Bitcoin mining machine out there at sea, co-located with your ocean thermal energy current supply on just this barge. And it can make the whole thing cost viable. So you get investment into a new renewable energy technology. So I see Bitcoin enabling not only the build out of existing renewable energy, but also allowing new forms of renewable energy that otherwise would never have been explored because they couldn't get across that economic barrier.
Yeah, or who have previously just been dismissed, right? I spoke to Nate last week, episode's already out. Absolutely mind-blowing, this guy. His knowledge on various things, I could have talked to him probably for 4 or 5 hours if I had wanted to. We would not have run out of topics. But shout out to Nate. Definitely. I mean, I come across this all the time, the amount of technology being enabled by a simple open source protocol, if you think about it, is absolutely mind-blowing. Like, you guess hashes. That's all you do,
and it's
right?
All completely
you produce
accidental.
Hashes, sorry.
It's all completely accidental.
It enables so much and unlocks so much potential. Do you see a future where maybe governments start realizing that they can connect stranded energy sources more economically viably by dedicating those resources to Bitcoin mining first and creating a cash flow? All right, short and sweet.
Because they're going to have to, right? If you look at what's happening with energy right now, they're going to have to. And the only reason they're not looking at it at the moment is because governments tend to be a little bit conservative and wait until other people have taken the risk. But once they can see that there's enough of it happening and it's no longer risky, what will happen is all the narrative about Bitcoin being bad for the environment, the oxygen will just be sucked out of that by the sheer weight of a counterexample. You can only do a media blackout for so long before it becomes so bleedingly obvious the amount of counterexamples that you can't ignore it anymore. It just suddenly people start to smell the truth. And governments will too. So yes, in terms of coming right back to that first question you asked about how do you gamify that disinformation, it happens by itself. If you look at what happens, the superior technology, the disruptive technology, always wins in the end. The car beat the horse and cart. The book bet inscribing on a tablet. The internet beats the print media, and Bitcoin mining will beat the fiat system. So the superior system always, the disruptive technology always wins, but it's not a smooth road to get there.
I love the picture you painted about the disruptee and the disruptor, or the disrupted and the disruptor, I guess. It hits the nail on the head there as well. So, Daniel, and maybe one last note, which just came to me. What's even more mind-blowing to me all the time is that all of this happens on a purely voluntary basis, just because of economic incentives, right? There's nobody saying you have to do this, you have to do that. It's just, it's financially a logical solution to use methane emissions or use methane.
Correct.
To mine
no one's regulated.
Instead of just releasing it to the air.
Correct. It just makes economic sense.
Absolutely. And I think it makes it even more strong, right? It makes its case even more strong. Right, there's a lot of technologies out there that need funding from the outside to become incumbent, right? To become prevalent, because it's not economic to sort of develop them in the first place, maybe at the beginning stage or whatever. But it's very different here. It just sort of prevails, I guess. Daniel, thank you so much for your time. Give people a bit of a handoff. How can we help? What do you require? Do you need people to do the unsexy math maybe? Where can people get in touch with you? I remember getting sort of in touch with you for the first time when you did a Zoom call on methane mining, I think, in co-work or collaboration with Adam Wright. What maybe give us an update also on how that's going, what are the plans?
Yeah, look, I think the best way, if you like Bitcoin mining and you like technology and you like energy, then look at doing it, look at getting into it. It's a fascinating area. And you'll be one of the pioneers. And I just encourage you, if those sorts of things appeal to you, then why not actually look at doing it, being one of these people who is creating the future through Bitcoin mining using these methane sources. Particularly if you're a climate activist and you actually want to do something positive that's going to make an immediate climate difference. Otherwise, I would just say, don't waste your energy into trying to be on the back foot defending Bitcoin's energy use. Just tell people that if it wasn't for Bitcoin's energy use, it wouldn't be able to mitigate our most dangerous greenhouse gas right now. And then point them to the increasing body of research that backs that up. In terms of how to get in touch with me, Twitter's probably the best way. So at DSBatten is my Twitter handle. And if people are really interested in diving into the weeds, probably most of you are, and I don't blame you. But it's there if you just look at Batcoins with a Z, or Z as they say in America, batcoins.com. That's where I do the more in-depth research.
All right, beautiful. I mean, look, if people listen to this, they should definitely go and read that. I read it. It's not a terribly long read.
Not a long read.
Right?
It's got you sit some down pretty with pictures a coffee, there.
You go yeah. through it. And yeah, it's got pretty pitchy. It's easy for the eye, and it definitely will teach you something new.
And I do make an effort to describe it in terms that make sense to people who aren't engineers, because I'm not one myself, so that's relatively straightforward.
Yeah, no, it'd be criminal to not tell people to read it after they listen to it. Beautiful. Thank you so much, Daniel, for your time. Guys, if you liked this episode, if you learned something new, please feel free to rate it, get in touch. If you have questions, as you saw, I asked 3 audience questions as well. So those are always, always welcome. Make sure to check out Value for Value Podcasting. I say this all the time. I will say it again. I hope you were able to take something away from this. Bitcoin does not consume enough electricity. Daniel has left his view on that previously, or when we started. And with that, I say until next time, have a good day. Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello, hello. If you're listening to this, it means you're right at the end of the episode. So thank you for listening. Recently, Relay got in touch with me and asked if I wanted a code. I said, yep, I use them anyway to DCA into Bitcoin. They offer a KYC light, easy way to do that. So just by paying as low as 1% fees, you can stack sats automatically into your own hardware wallet, and that's well worth the peace of mind, I think. Relay is available in most European nations, and they offer an OTC desk for more volume as well, where the ref code is applicable. If you want to support the show and you DCA anyway, or you want to start doing it, I'm happy if you use my code. It'll help me out a little bit without you having to do anything. The ref code is simple. It's just my name, Jesse, J-E-S-S-E. So yeah, find the link in the show description and see you next time. Peace.